So good evening, everyone, and welcome to our Parsha of the Week class, Parsha Vayishlach, 5775, to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. Sounds like a Monday Night Football heading. Why Jacob gave Esau the world. So we want to build up Yaakov Avinu's resume here and try to explain why the jaws of victory were very much inevitable had he chosen that path. So let's look at source 1 at the bottom of the page. This comes to us courtesy of Bereshis, Genesis 32, Pasuk Chof Tes, 29th verse. So the angel, at the beginning of our parsha, of course, he's left alone and an angel comes and wrestles all night with Jacob. And the angel then says to Jacob, I have to go. Jacob says, sure, on one condition. Give me a bracha, I want a blessing. So the angel says, no longer will it be said that your name is Jacob, Yaakov, but Israel. For you have striven with the divine, an angel, me, moi, and with man, Esau, and your uncle Laban, and Vatuchal. You have overcome all of them, all your adversaries. Therefore, you have, for the first time in human history, acquired and earned the mantle Israel, which has this expression of sarita, to be engaged. No, but it's more than this. Jacob has spent 20 long dark years with Laban, his uncle. So nefarious was Laban that he was untouchable there. Even Esau would have not dared to go over and mess with his uncle Laban. He knew what Laban was like. Laban was the source of all darkness in the world. So he comes back from Laban's house, and he has somehow, as we spoke about on Shabbat, he has outfoxed the fox, the master, one step ahead of him, somehow, miraculously. And he even sends a report to his brother Esau. He sends these messengers, these malachim, and he says, look, tell my brother the following. Im Lavan Garti, I dwelled with Laban for 20 years, but I'm back. I kept the Torah perfectly, flawlessly. I'm still Jacob. Now that message must have been received on the Esau end with tremendous anguish and trepidation. For he must have thought, oh my gosh, how could Jacob overcome Uncle Laban? What? So that sets the stage. He's basically threatening Esau without threatening him, saying, look, if you mean to harm me, look, if Laban can't harm me, how can you, Esau? How can you hope to harm me? I mean, Laban has the spiritual destruction of the world at in his power, and he couldn't harm me. You're going to harm me? Come on, think again. So, at that point, Esau is very, very much respectful of the potential power that Jacob could bring to bear. So much so that he gathers up 400 generals, army men, and they come, and it's not clear what his intention is, but whether it's to pay homage, you know, to pay honor to Jacob, or to militarily have a conflict with him, but whatever it is, Esau is in awe of Jacob's capabilities. Just that 20-year legacy with Laban and overcoming and defeating Laban at his own game is enough to give this Jacob goody-two-shoes a transformative vision in the eyes of Esau. But more than that, the night before he meets Esau in battle, he meets Esau's protective angel, we are told, in battle. And he beats him. So he beats the unbeatable. No, it sounds like the impossible dream, right? He literally takes on the spiritual essence, an angel. Some say it was the Yetzer Hara, the evil incarnation, which is the representative of the nation of Esau. And he battles him mano a mano all night long. And in the end, the angel goes up and says, let me go. I give up. You have what you want. You want to be Israel? Here you go. It's Israel. And so at that point, Esau, who the next morning, the physical Esau, not the spiritual manifestation, the real guy is going to meet up with Jacob. And he must have felt, oh my gosh, I'm ready to acquiesce, because obviously Jacob has some serious ammunition. He has the nuclear bomb option, and we're not going to go there. So he's scared of him. But then, let's start with source number 2. Jacob capitulates to Esau in epic ways. If you remember the tragedy of World War II with the Prime Minister of England, the infamous Neville Chamberlain, Mr. Peace in our time, right? The one who went over to meet Hitler, Yimach Shmo, in Berlin and came back with good news. We will have peace in our time. Of course, the word was peace, spelled P-I-E-C-E, and it was simply a piece of land that he was going to keep taking from every country. But you know, he was delusional, obviously, right? And eventually they schlepped for Mr. Churchill out of retirement and said, you know, we need you back, boss. Here you go. And Sir Winston won the war along with some very other able assistance of the Americans and the Russians, okay? But that was the idea of capitulation. Well, this is almost on that scale. Jacob, number two, prostrated himself on the ground 7 times as he approached his brother. Turn to the back, please. Then it says in number three, he did not stop bowing and then bowing again. And in fact, the Medrash says that just when Esau thought, well, you can't keep bowing, you know, going down to the earth to show such humility in my presence, he goes again and again and again. And Esau actually is quoted in an oral tradition in the Medrash by saying to himself, wait a minute, I don't get it. Here he has that nuclear option. I mean, I know he has it. But why is he treating me with such deference? I mean, he sent Esau millions of dollars worth of animals, of gifts. He is sending him message after message that I am your servant, you're my master. And then he starts bowing and capitulating in front of him. So, very strange behavior on behalf of Jacob. Why doesn't Jacob, you know, use the power that he's won? He's now Israel for the first time. He just got the mantle last night, but now he's acting like he has to kiss the boots of Esau. What's going on? So Esau, number four, says to him, look, he says, I understand that maybe you're not as such hot stuff that I thought you were. I heard that you were really a legendary combatant. Maybe you're not such hot stuff. So Esau offers him. He said, look, let's travel onwards together, the brothers, and I will walk as your counterpart. Number five, and this is a quote right from the Zohar, that mystical work that Rabbi Becher quoted with us. Right? And the Zohar said that Esau said, let's proceed together. We will divide this world and rule together. Okay, let's step back for a second. So you have Jacob at the height of his powers. He has just attained the mantle Israel. He has overcome the impossible, Laban. And he comes and he starts to behave like he's a garnish, like he's a nothing. Like he needs somehow Esau to validate his life. And Esau's kind of taken back, but okay. Esau says, I'll make you an offer. He thought it would be one you couldn't refuse. But as you'll see, Jacob's going to refuse in a very big way. And he says, look, let's let the past be the past. We're brothers. We share more genetics than anyone else in the world. We're twins. Let's take care of this world ourselves. You and I together? Come on, the sons of Isaac, the sons of Rebekah, together? The world will be our oyster. Now you think that that's, you know, a sincere offer. And it seems to be a very sincere offer. But listen to what Jacob says in reply. This is number six. I put it in the Hebrew because it's really a transformative line that will shape history. So Jacob says to him, Yavor na Adoni, Lifnei Avdo, please let my Adon, like Adon Olam, let my Lord, my Master pass, Lifnei Avdo, ahead before his servant. Now the word Eved is more than just a servant. Really, we use it as a slave, right? So he's really saying, let my Lord pass before his slave. You go on ahead. Now, it was more than just you go on ahead. Have a look at number seven. Because back in the Zohar takes it to another level altogether. Jacob said like this, let Esau master civilization first. I will have to suffer your, meaning Esau's, exile, the Galut, until the time comes for me to rule the mountain of Esau. Stop. Do you know when it will be that Jacob's going to rule over Esau? When the mountain of Esau? We say this in our liturgy every day. We say, Balu Moshiim Bahar Tzion Lishvot Et Har Esau. We're going to come, go up to the mountain of Edom, of Esau. We're going to judge him. But you know when that's going to happen? When the Messiah comes, Mashiach. So it's 2,000 years, basically, that Esau's had the upper hand. I mean, because we're going back now to the destruction of Temple number 2 in the year 70. And the Romans are progeny of Edom, Esau. Their lineage is traced directly to Esau. So he's essentially giving license now for the Romans to not only destroy our temple in Jerusalem, but to send us into exile, which we are still there, overall, over the world, spread out all over the world. And he still rules Anu Yamazan until this very day.
When it says, suffer your exile, this means I will have to endure your supremacy until I take
over. Correct.
So, in fact, I will be in exile from
where
I could be until you...
Correct. I mean, even though Jews are living in Israel, Baruch Hashem, thank God we have Israel, we're still considered in exile because there's no temple. It's only when the temple shall be rebuilt that we're considered not in exile. Okay? Now, if you think of the suffering, you know, every generation of Jews who's had to live under, shall we say, the thumb of the Gentile nations, and sometimes it was okay for a little while, sometimes it didn't have a very happy ending, right? And it's been a nightmarish 2,000 years. If you trace this back and go from the time of the end of the Roman Empire, right? When Attila and the Huns and all the you know, they overrun the Roman Empire at the end, and it hasn't been exactly a nice time for Jews anywhere. I mean, every time in Europe, over and over again, you know, we're doing well for a little while, we do a little too well, all of a sudden, goodbye, pack up your things, shalom habracha, bye, right? And it got worse and worse and worse. You had pogroms, inquisitions, and the ultimate inquisition pogrom, the Shoah, the Holocaust. Now, what in the world was Jacob thinking? Number 8, God, in response to Jacob's offer to Esau, pass on, God says, okay, Jacob, you want to have it your way? Let's play it by your rules. Listen to what he says. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Holy One, said, by your life, Jacob. Okay, I accept it. We'll play it just as you say. Esau is going to dominate you in this world. He's going to always have the upper hand against you. Now, this is so definitive that the Talmud, in number 9, is going to tell us something stunning. Listen to this Talmud, okay? It's number question. This is source number 9. For 26 years, Rome kept her treaties with Israel, means with the Jewish people living in Israel, but then turned and subjugated Israel, the Jewish people. So for 26 years, whatever bargains were struck between the leaders of Israel and the Roman Empire, Rome held their treaty. They didn't persecute the Jews. So what changed? Well, originally, they, meaning the Romans, followed the lesson of Esau's first offer. Now remember, Esau is their great-grandfather. So they studied the Bible. They had the Septuagint, right, the Greek translation. They studied it. And they said, well, let's look. Esau, if he's our great-great-grandfather, ostensibly, we inherited our greatness from Esau. Let's emulate Esau. Grandpa Esau said to Jacob, the grandpa of the Jews, let us travel onwards together and I will walk as your counterpart. So let's treat the Jews in a benign way. Let's be nice to the Jews. But then, the Talmud goes on to say, they followed the lesson of Jacob's reply to Esau when he said, no, please pass ahead, my master. They said, oh, wait a minute. Esau was so nice. But Jacob rebuffed his offer of friendship and camaraderie and conquering of the world. So you know what? Let's rethink the Jewish problem. Now, obviously, this is not a literal. I mean, the Romans did not sit. You know, Caesar did not sit down and say, okay, let's study the text. Let's get some rabbis in, have some classes and analyze. It just means that their behavior emulated the nature of this relationship between Esau and Jacob and the give and take between Esau and Jacob. So for 26 years, they were benign. They allowed the Jews in Israel to have their own individuality and their own rule. Everything was okay, paralleling the offer of Esau, granddaddy. But then when they study what Jacob said in reply to Esau, they said, oh, okay, well, let's go after the Jews. Let's get rid of that temple. After all, it is a problem. So you see that the give and take between Esau and Jacob, which happened in our Torah reading, is monumental because it impacted literally to this day us. Because it was the subjugation of the Roman Empire that led to the destruction of the Roman Empire. And the current situation we are in the exile right now, is the exile of Esau traced to the Romans. So they emulated his behavior. Okay?
The 26-year period can be specifically traced, which 26-year period it was before the destruction.
Correct. Well, it's actually, you can actually trace historically there was a period of time where the Romans were benign, relatively benign, I mean, for the Romans. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, there's an amazing relationship. One of the great rabbis of the Talmud, who was the redactor of the Mishnah. His name was Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. He actually had an amazing, amazing relationship with a real-life figure named Antoninus, Anthony. Like, amazing, to the point where the two of them were like they each knew who they were from. Like Antoninus knew Anthony was living in Israel, and they became best pals, and one knew he was from Esau, one knew he was from Jacob, and they treated each other friendly, in a very friendly way, and they were loving towards each other. It was amazing. Of course, it changed later on with the, it changed later. But that is something that happened. Okay. Now, at this point then, let's just take a step back. Let's just stop. So here's the question. What was Jacob thinking? So that's the lesson tonight we're trying to explore.
That's what I was just asking myself.
What was Jacob thinking? So now we understand the nature of the class's title, right? How to snatch defeat from sure victory. All Jacob had to do was keep his head up. No more bowing. No. I'm going to meet Esau on the battlefield. Esau messes with me. I'll do to him what I did to his angel last night. It's over. Right? No, doesn't do it. But worse, right? He starts bowing and he capitulates and he uses language. Deliberately so. Every word he uses is nuanced. You're my master. I'm your servant. Come on, go on ahead. Right? What in the world was Jacob doing? Why not stand up? I mean, my gosh, you're Israel. Stand up, right? It's eerily reminiscent of the way, they made the war, what was the movie with the Most Roared, where the country decides to declare war against America, knowing that the reparations will be millions of dollars. So you declare war, you lose, and then America has to feed you millions of dollars and feed your families, remember?
The Duchy of Grand Fenwick.
Right. So it's the same idea that here you have Goliath in the room, and there's a little ant running around, and the ant somehow, you have to bow down to the ant. Like what? Mm-hmm. Right? And yet we do it today. I mean, we're too embarrassed to use our own strength. If you think about the reality of it, right? We have enormous strength. We have so much strength, so much so that we're actually told, well, you can't do that. Like, I'll give you an example. It's a classic, okay? I'm just straying up, but this is humorous to me in a dark way, okay? Modern day piracy. So you remember, they made a movie this last year, right? With Tom Hanks as the pirate of that ship that was taken hostage, right? You remember the story. So you have real guys in Somalia who are basically homeless guys who go out in these little, not even rowboats, right? And they try to abduct people who are with these big tankers and the cargo ships and try to hold them ransom and they're successful. Now, what would it take for America or any Western power to stop the pirates tomorrow? It would take a couple buttons. A guy in Washington could sit there with his computer, could target a couple of smart bombs or a couple of cruise missiles. The drone comes over. They find the tribal leader. What do they call those guys? Like Fahit? What's that? They have names. They're the warlords. Thank you. You target the warlord, who's the guy in charge. You say, Mr. Warlord, either you stop your gentlemen from getting in the boats. Here's a little message from Uncle Sam, right? And you just show a little will. Boom! No more pirates. But no. We're told you can't do that, right? These people feel they're starving. They have, right? What? Right, I mean, it's lunacy. You have pirates in 2014 who are haunting the, right? But you can't touch them. Why? Because the New York Times says it's off limits. You can't hurt those people. What do you mean? Well, because you're too powerful. It's the same thing here. Here you have the nuclear option, ostensibly, that Jacob has to put in his pocket. Someone tells him, I don't know who or why, but you're not allowed to use this. You have to kowtow and acquiesce to every demand that Esau gives you. You have to butter him up and give him gifts and give him presents and kiss and bow before him because he's Esau after all. Well, it doesn't make any sense, does it? Unless it does. Because what I'd like to offer you tonight is the following. That Jacob knew exactly what he was doing. And he was so careful in his treatment and the dialogue between himself and Esau. He knew that this is a monumental meeting. The meeting of these two future world powers. Now, I know the Jewish people are not exactly the world power the same way that Rome and the others are, but in a spiritual sense, and in many other ways we are. So these two brothers, Jacob and Esau, this fateful meeting would define to this moment the way the world works. And when Jacob gave away the store, when he said, the world's your oyster, you pass on ahead, and as we said, I'll just take civilization second. You build the world. Anissa did a really good job, right? I mean, the Romans did a phenomenal job. Western world, everything we have, all the culture, everything we have is from the Roman Empire, from the Greeks. They did a phenomenal job, both in culture and infrastructure and what they've given the world. There's some marvelous things here. So Esau did a really good job building the world. But the Jews were always kind of in the background, on the periphery. As Jacob said, I'll come second, you go first. Why? Aha. Number 10. The entire period that Jacob spent in Beit El living with his family, he would continuously honor Esau with even more tribute. So it wasn't enough that he sent him millions of dollars worth of animals at the time that he met him after his return from Laban's house. No, that wasn't enough. Every month or so, he'd dispatch, go online with Amazon, and he'd find whatever Esau likes, boom, boom, make a couple purchases. Next day, UPS delivers them, and Esau's happy. Oh, I got more presents from Jacob. Wonderful, wonderful. Now, number 11, Esau acted offended, meaning, come on, you're trying to bribe me here? But he kept his hand open the whole time. Now, I don't know if I shared this story, but it's a cute little story. My father, Alashon, once went to see the Tonight Show being taped, the real Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, you know? And my father was in Los Angeles doing some work, and I think someone gave free tickets at the hotel, so I think they recorded about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So it wasn't such a Tonight Show. But it was recorded live. See, he says that Johnny Carson would come on the stage, and they'd have the big applause signs in the background off stage. You couldn't see them. And Carson, of course, he's famous. So everyone was very excited. Everyone stood up and they're cheering, yeah. And at some point, after 30, 40 seconds, it becomes embarrassing, right? So you see on stage, on camera, rather, Carson starts to go like this, right? And he's looking sheepish. It's enough. But my father says, but what you didn't see is that underneath the camera, Johnny Carson's going like this, louder. So at the same time, he's going like, I'm embarrassed. He's going, come on, bring it on. So that's Esau, right? So Esau saying to his brother Jacob, Jacob's giving him gifts. No, I can't accept it. Keep going. No, come on, I can't take any more money from you. Keep it coming, right? So it's like this. Now, why was this necessary? We're going to see this as a critical component, that Jacob understood his brother's mindset, that he wanted to retain his dignity, and yet, he wanted the money at the same time. Okay, but there was a purpose behind it. It's very nuanced. We'll come back to that. Number 12. This is an amazing quote. The world was created only for the completely evil or the completely righteous. For one, there was created, Olam Haba, the next world, the world to come. For the other, meaning the wicked, there was created Olam Hazeh, this world. Now, that's an amazing, staggering statement. So you know what that means? Very simple. Okay? If you live your life in a righteous way, then you benefit both in this world, but you get the next world. But if you're already a nefarious Rasha, a wicked person, denying yourself in this world when you're really not going to get anything in the next world doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. In other words, the person who truly doesn't believe in the next world, in the afterlife, why should they live their life with tremendous constraints? Because the piety and the righteousness is really not going to come to you in the next world, won't be repaid. So why deny yourself now? So what is this parallel? This parallels the nature of Esau versus Jacob. Because what is Esau all about? Esau's all about this world. And in fact, the blessing from Jacob and Esau that they received, they both received almost the same blessing from Isaac. Because remember, even though Isaac blessed Jacob first, when he left, Esau begged him, please, there's a blessing for me, yeah? So, well, if you look carefully, there's only one word real difference. One word. With Esau, it's, here is your gift. With Jacob, it's, your gift will be. Yiten, future tense. So Isaac is saying to Esau, here's the world, enjoy. Go gezinter hay, have fun. With Jacob, it's, you'll get the reward next world. Now, it's a time for work. It's a time for restraint. It's a time to be pious. It's a time to make a difference in this world. But you will get the next world coming to you. Whereas Esau, it's fast food. Here it is, ready to eat. Kind of like the reason we call him Mr. Red, Big Red, right? Because the food is ready to eat. He wants fast food. He wants it now. So that's what this is saying. That if a person is completely evil, then he should really benefit from this world. And if a person is righteous, they will benefit in the next world. Okay? Number 13, look at this quote. Esau hated the birthright in the first place, and he would have eventually begged Jacob to take it off his hands even if he would have had to pay him, says the Zohar. Now, he made a big fuss about it. Why? Because he lost it. But in the end, when he realized, what is the birthright from Isaac and Abraham all about? Oh, it's about religion? You mean I can't murder? No. I can't pillage and rape and do all those fun things I enjoy doing? Sorry, Mr. Esau, you got to go to shul, put on talis and tefillah, and you got to give charity. One wife. Well, I guess, yeah, Jacob had more than one wife, so I guess that in one area we're a little lenient. At least Jacob was, right? But no more pillaging and rummaging, no more pogroms and inquisitions and bloodletting. He says, like, well, wait a minute, what do you mean? I'm Mr. Red. That's who I am. I don't want this birthright stuff. So had he not sold the birthright for the chalent and the gold that we said he sold it for last week, in the end he would have come to Jacob and said, you know, Jacob, do you remember as kids that we... Would you buy it off my hands? I don't want the spiritual stuff. It's not for me. I want this world. I don't want constraints on who I am, morality and all that nonsense. I want to live, right? Now, staggeringly, it was given to him. Look at number 14. For in this week's Parsha, Jacob says to Esau, please take my blessing, birchati, as it has been brought to you. Now, the rabbis say, well, what is that blessing? The blessing is referring to the blessing from dad, Isaac. He says, you want the blessing? It's yours. Look at number 15. In our parsha, this is amazing, okay? I love this quote, number 15. So said Jacob to Esau, he says, look, and they're meeting. This is when they're meeting, and he's, you know, telling them that you're my master, and I'm the Eved, I'm the slave, and you go on ahead, and you have everything. He says, look, take my blessing. Now, ostensibly, what is that word blessing referring to? The presents he gave him. I gave you $1 million of presents, keep them, right? But the illusion of the word bracha, he didn't use the word, matana, gift, mincha, offering, tribute. He uses the word blessing. Now, let me ask you a crazy question. Okay, think about it. It's kind of silly. What was the one word that if you're Jacob and you've had, 22 years to think about the meeting with Esau, that you're going to meet him again after 22 years, okay? And you know that there's one thing that you dare not remind Esau about. What would it be? Maybe the word blessing? Oh my gosh, so what does he say to him? They're meeting, right? He says, by the way, remember the bracha that I gave you, meaning the gifts? Keep them. You talk about a slip of the tongue. Oh my gosh. The one word which is sure to get Esau going berserk. Hey, remember the bracha, dear brother Esau? So if Esau has forgiven and forgotten, and you just threw dynamite, you just threw gasoline on the fire, really you're going to use the word bracha? Why not say the word gifts? No, he uses the word blessing. So on one level, it means literally, take my blessing that I had. You know, you're angry 22 years later. You want it? It's yours. So listen to what it says here. Said Jacob to Esau, here, take both blessings, yours and mine, meaning the one that says, here and now is your blessing and the world to come. You can have both. I don't care. Take my blessing here. It's yours. So Esau answered and said, no. Well, that's not fair. I want only the blessing that was originally meant for me by my father Isaac. Meaning, you took mine, let's switch back the way it should have been. The blessing that was meant to be yours should now go to you, let's switch. Meaning, the second blessing that I got, I'll give it to you, Jacob. And in return, you give me the one that you took from dad, the first one. That's what I want, right? Sounds like a fair deal. So they wrote up a contract between them and signed on transferring the blessings back to the way they were meant to be. Meaning Esau got his original blessing that he was always angry about, and Jacob got the second blessing. This is the fun part. When Esau came triumphantly home, thinking, oh my gosh, hey, family, you won't believe it. It's taken like a half a lifetime. But I got the blessings back! You remember I told you the story how my brother Jacob dressed up and he fooled my dad Isaac? I have a contract! I got the blessing back. And he was so happy with himself, right? And his family looks at him like he's an idiot. Listen to what his family says. Everyone objected. I can imagine the scene. It's a very visual scene. Everyone in the family of Esau objected and said, what, are you crazy? What you have done is ridiculous. You took blessings focused on Olam Haba, on the next world, and left Jacob with this world. Are you crazy? Try to get him to accept them back again. So it says that Esau came back to Jacob and begged him, please tear up the contract. I want it the way it used to be. Now, what was the, it's hysterical, right? But what was the point of this? Whether it really happened in a real way or not. But what's the message? The blessing of this world is perfect for Esau. The blessing for the next world is perfect for us, the Jewish people, for Jacob. So for him to give up his pursuit of the monetary, what do they call it, the golden dream, is insane. That's what Esau was designed for. So his own family says, Esau, I don't understand. You're the richest man in the world now. Aren't you happy with your life? Yeah, of course. So don't you understand that if you now take Jacob's blessing, this all goes away? He's like, oh, you idiot, go back. We don't want the next world. We want this world. Come on. Remember what it said before? The really righteous, they get the next world. You're not exactly that guy. You're not Jacob. You're not the goody two-shoes like your brother. Go switch it back. So he went and he switched it back.
Well, the whole family was like,
exactly. Or worse, as we'll see. Or worse. All right. Stop for a second. So let's reiterate where we're holding. So we asked the question, why in the world did Jacob snatch a defeat from sure victory? He had the nuclear option to destroy Esau. At the very minimum, Esau makes a very generous offer. Let's be together. No, can't. You go on ahead. You take the world. I'll take the remnants, the leftovers. Really, I don't want leftovers. I want to. Why do the Jewish people always have to be sort of at the tail end of things? Why can't we be the inventors and the creators of this world and the ones who rule? Why are we always sort of like marginalized and pushed off into the corners? And why? Why did Jacob do this to us? Okay, and then it talks about the idea that even though Esau didn't know it himself, but in the end, when he analyzed the nature of his blessing versus the nature of the one that Jacob got from Isaac, Esau came to the understanding that, you know what, it was really perfect. Jacob got the goody-two-shoes blessing, the one for the world to come. He got heaven. I don't want that stuff. I want this world. I want money. I want power, prestige. I want no constraints. And that's how I'm happy. I'm like a pig in the muck. That's what I want. And to deny Esau that is insane. His own family said that to him. Okay? So possibly, Jacob is actually so smart that he's protecting us from the wrath of Esau. Now, why? Why is that so? Because we're going to see now that there was one tiny snippet of Esau's genetics, shall we say, his DNA, that got that old-time religion in it. That these genetics became religious. And God help us. Just the one tiny bit of Esau that became into religion almost destroyed the Jewish people multiple times, as we're going to see. And what Jacob was doing is genius. He's saying, look, Esau, you want this world? It's yours. I'm not into this world. Okay, fine. I'll live nicely. I can still have money and I can still, you know, but you're going to be at the vanguard of everything great in this world. I'll be at the end. I don't need what you have. But he says, well, let's walk together. No, I don't want to walk together. Because he knows that if Esau and Jacob are walking together, there's going to come a time where it's not a benign relationship. Esau's going to kind of start casting the evil eye towards brother Jacob, meaning the Jewish people, us. And he's going to say, how come you guys are doing so well? You know, for somebody who said they gave up this world, you got a lot of money. In fact, Esau makes that comment. When he meets up with Jacob on the battlefield here, ostensibly, and he looks around, he sees all the children and the money, and he says, wait a minute, Jacob, who does this all belong to? Me, Jacob says. Interesting. You know, for a man of the cloth, you're doing pretty good. You're supposed to be living, you know, an austere lifestyle, but I'm looking around now, and I don't see austerity anywhere, right? He says, this is pretty good. But that's the point. That Jacob specifically is distancing Esau from himself. He's saying, you go ahead. And in fact, the words of the Torah are so beautiful. He says, Vani et nahala le'iti. I'm going to go at my own slow pace, according to the children and the animals. And he says, I got lots of pregnant animals and pregnant wives and little babies. and I got diapers to change, and I got babies and families to raise. Now, all those words are guaranteed to do what to Esau? To drive him nuts, right? Because this is the last thing Esau would ever do. You're going to invest in this world with babies and with animals, and you gotta get up and change diapers in the middle of the night and crying babies? This is not for me. You're right. You know what, Jacob? You do what your own thing. I'm going on ahead. Thank you. Bye. And in fact, he says this to his brother. He says, you really want to stay with me and walk with me and do all this that I'm investing in this world? This is for you, Esau? And Esau's like grossed up by the whole prospect of the dirty diapers and the children and the family and the crying babies. He doesn't want any of that. He wants mistresses when he wants them, and he doesn't want them by, right? I want pleasure. I don't want all this pain and agony and child rearing. This is not for me. So Jacob is clearly throwing this at Esau, saying, look, just go on ahead, big brother. You take it all. I don't want anything. I'm not in a hurry to get anywhere. Because Esau's clearly in a hurry, right? He's all about satisfaction, immediate gratification. I want it now, and I want it right now in my hands. I don't want to wait. Jacob's like, we can wait. We're the Jewish people. We invest. If not now, it'll be my children, my grandchildren. But we'll get there. As you go on up ahead, we'll get to catch up with you, 2,000 years. Is that okay? Sure. And Esau goes, says bye, never doesn't leave anybody behind, and Esau's gone. So we are now going to see something staggering, in my opinion. That there was one snippet of Esau that got the old-time religion bug. And it got it in such a profound way that we're almost not having this discussion tonight as we're going to talk about it. Okay? You ready? Number 16. When Esau heard his father Isaac's words, this is going back to last 2 weeks ago now, to Toldot, okay? This is when Esau has come in with the food, and he says to dad Isaac, stand, bless me, here's your food. Remember, and Isaac is shaking, like, who's this? I don't know. I thought, your brother, he came and he took your blessings, right? And Esau goes nuts. And then he actually breaks down in tears and he cries. One anguished, heartfelt, spiritual cry. Perhaps at that one moment, Esau, you could argue, felt the enormity of the loss of the birthright and everything spiritual. Meaning, he is defining his future as now. There is no future of the world to come. And he's okay with that normally. But at that one instant, he deeply felt a connection to Isaac, to Abraham, and to the loss of who he could have been, the potential of another world that could have existed for him. And he cries, and it's anguish, it's heartfelt. When Esau heard his father Isaac's words, he screamed, it says, an exceedingly anguished and bitter cry. He says, bless me too, my father. And he's in tears. And they're genuine. Isaac blesses him at that moment because he realizes, oh my gosh, this is a moment of absolute truth from Mr. Lies, Esau. Now, what did that one cry do? Listen to what it did. Number 17. Now we got to fast forward. Oh, I don't know. Story of Purim, anybody? Mordechai heard that Haman had gotten Ahasuerus's ring, and in the name of King Ahasuerus, he has sent out an edict, exterminate every Jew. Men, women, children, they're all dead, right? Mordechai hears that the letter has been sent. What does Mordechai do? 17. Mordechai knew what was happening, and Mordechai tore his clothes and cried an exceedingly anguished and bitter cry. Word for word, the words used by God to describe the feelings and the cry of Esau. And the rabbis connect the two in the Gemara and the Talmud and say it's payback time. Because Jacob made Esau emit this heartfelt cry and 1 minute of actual loss was felt by Esau, then someone from Jacob's family has got to get paid back. And Mordechai was paid back generations later when he heard that a son of Esau, because remember, Haman comes from Esau. He's a direct descendant, as we're going to see. He's an Amalekite. And the Amalekite nation comes from Esau. So part of Esau becomes Amalek, becomes Haman, and tries to destroy the Jews. And Mordechai cries when he hears the Jews are about to be annihilated. So the cry is Mida Keneged Mida. Quid pro quo. Okay, but it gets better than that. Where did Amalek come from? Number 18. So Timnah was a mistress to Eliphaz, son of Esau. So the Talmud says, wait a minute. What do we care that there was a girl named Timnah who was a mistress to Eliphaz, the only firstborn son of Esau, Mr. Big Red. What does it teach us? The Talmud goes on to say that Timna was a princess, because it says noble Lotan implies noble Timna. She wasn't just some harlot. She was nobility. She was noble. Well, how did she go from being a noble woman to a prostitute? Because she literally prostitutes herself to be with Eliphaz. Eliphaz says, I don't want you as a wife. Could I be your girlfriend? Okay, fine. I could always use more in the harem. So Eliphaz, son of Esau, allows his girl Timna to join his family as part of his harem, as a prostitute, right? Well, how did this happen? How did someone who was nobility become a prostitute? So Talmud says that she, Timna, wanted to join the Jewish people and approached the big guys, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, but none of them would have her. They all must have sensed about Timna there was something a little off about her. So she went to them and said, look, can I marry into the family? Anywhere. And Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob all said, sorry, this is just not a good thing. Sorry, Timna. So then she went to become a mistress to Esau's son Eliphaz. And she said, I'd rather be a maid among this nation, meaning the Jewish people, than a princess among any other. So yeah, sure, I'm a princess in my own people, but my people are garbage. I would rather be a prostitute and a harlot if I can be some part of the extended family of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, even if it's on the Esau side of the family, and better that than being a princess in my own family. And what came of her, the Talmud says, Timna was a mistress to Eliphaz, son of Esau, and she bore him a Malek, the Talmud says. Wow, listen to this. Timna somehow takes the spiritual part of Esau that was given to Esau's firstborn son, Eliphaz. And remember, it's not really full Esau, it's just part of Esau's genetics. But then Timna, who's this fanatical girl willing to give up being a princess and willing to prostitute herself just to become part of the Jewish people, that fanaticism married with the hatred that Esau normally has for Jacob that comes together, oh, does that create a toxic mix? Mr. Toxicity, Amalek, Hitler, everybody comes from this. So one tiny genetic part of Esau gets transformed through Timna's fanaticism and Amalek. You have Haman, you have all the horrific nature of Jew haters everywhere in history from one part, okay? Number 19 we can skip. Let's go to number 20. This is one of the single most staggering pieces of Talmud you're ever going to hear. I put it in Hebrew there, but I'll read it in English to you, okay? Number 20. If you want to know where Hitler came from, would you be surprised that the Talmud actually traces the lineage of Hitler? Listen to this. Said Jacob to the Holy One, he prayed to God. He said, Ribbono shel Olam, Master of the World. He says, do not allow Esau his heart's desire. Do not remove his bit, meaning that what's controlling him, to allow him access to just do whatever he wants to do, to act with total inhibition. This prayer that Jacob uttered refers to, and the Talmud quotes it, Germania of Edom. Now, who is Edom? Edom is Esau, right? Edom is the name the Torah gave for Big Red, means red, because he wanted the red lentils. But what about Germania? Germania is Germany. For if they, the Talmud says, were to be let loose from this bit, they would destroy the world. Now, when was this written? This was not written like post-World War II. This is written 1,500 years before World War II even was a blink in the eye. So this is a Talmud that is quoting Jacob as saying, please, I know that within elements of my brother Esau, there are elements of this virus. This virus is Amalek, and this virus eventually will become Germania, the Germans, and eventually they're going to destroy the world if you let them, which they almost did, as we know, in our own lifetime. So what was Jacob doing? It's staggering, all right? Jacob understood this, and Jacob is praying to God, please, God, don't let my brother become interested in religion. And that's why he keeps bribing him with gifts. Remember we talked about how important that was? How he kept saying, I don't want the money, but then he kept his hand open? Because if you give him the gifts and the money,
it's making him very, he knows he's taking a bribe, and that's not really a righteous thing. So you're keeping him happy with money. It comes at a cost to Esau because he's becoming apathetic about religion. But that's what he's supposed to be. Remember, the world is only made for the totally righteous and the totally wicked, correct? To really enjoy this world. If Esau, who is totally wicked, is denied pleasure in this world, what will happen? He'll start to get interested in religion, into Jacob, and who's Jacob, and how come I gave up my birthright? He tricked me, blah, blah, the Jews, right? And then all of a sudden, what do you have? Anti-Semitism. All of a sudden, as a result of this, boom, you have elements of Esau that become interested in religion. And my friends, it almost worked.
And that's what it means when it says, do not allow Esau his heart's desire. In other words, if his tendency or that part of him that might want
to seek out the next world, righteousness, to believe that he could still be Israel. Mm-hmm. Now, the craziest thing is that Jacob was undermined. He almost pulled it off, meaning, Esau, go ahead. I'll stay here. You go ahead. I'm the servant. You're my master. I'm not going to... In other words, he's given away the world by design because he understands that, oh my gosh, if Jacob and Esau go together as partners, Esau then is continually reminded of the spiritual part that he gave up because it's right there. It's a thorn. He wants Esau to be apathetic about religion, not interested in religion. He wants Esau just to grovel in the mud and enjoy this world. Go on ahead. It's all yours. As soon as Esau becomes a little too religious or interested in religion, oh my gosh, the Jews don't survive. And you see that this one little element of Esau's family, through his son Eliphaz that marries this crazy lady named Timnah, creates this nightmare vision called Amalek. Everything in the world that tries to literally exterminate the Jews, that's pathological in its hatred of everything Jacob, is created through that little snippet of the religion part of Esau. Now, where did it all become undermined? It's for another discussion, but I'll leave you with something just to think about. Okay? The Romans are descended from Esau. What organization came and is with us to this day, came out of the Roman Empire as an official entity that became very, very powerful, and that told the followers of this religion and of this lifestyle that, guess what, you are Israel. The Jews are not Israel. There's a new covenant, and there's something called Israel.
It's Christianity.
Roman Christianity, called Roman Catholics, correct? Mm-hmm. What did Rome offer to the children of Esau? They offered him a birthright. They said, you lost it? You sold it? No. I'll give it back to you. It's yours. Here it is. There's only one price to pay. What's the price the Roman Catholicism has, unfortunately for the Jewish people, has enforced? Austerity. Right? Adherents, are they allowed to possess millions of dollars? Are they allowed to commit all types of heinous crimes? No. Because they're given religion that constrains them. Do you think it's a coincidence that in the last 2,000 years, since the rise of Roman Catholicism in our world, do you think it's a coincidence that the amount of Jewish bloodshed through pogroms and inquisitions, and ultimately the ultimate manifestation through the Holocaust, do you think it's a coincidence as it was always done with the cross and with the shield? And if you look historically, the more religious the country was, like Spain and Poland, these countries, the more vitriolic the anti-Semitism was in those countries. Like, that cannot be a coincidence. And so that undermined, unfortunately, a part of the effect of what Jacob tried to do. Because what Jacob tried to do is keep all things Esau not interested in religion. But here you have a religion that comes along and basically says to the followers of the Western world, guess what? All is not lost. You can have a new covenant. You can be Israel. In other words, they don't say that you're something else. They say you're Israel. It's a new Israel. What does that mean? That all the things that were lost can be yours again, but it comes at a tremendous cost. So what happens? This is a nightmare vision. The real adherents, the ones who became insanely anti-Jewish, how did this happen? You know what happens? Very simple. They had a place in this world, to enjoy the fruits of their hand, to not be inhibited by guilt and by all these things that are introduced to them. So they had that potential. So it's taken away. Church says, Roman Catholic Church says, you can't have any of that stuff anymore. Women, off limits. You can't have You can't just go out and do whatever you want to do. Sorry, it's not for you. You're religious. You're going to be like Jacob. You're Israel. But wait a minute. My place in this world was from my dad and from my ancestry was supposed to be just to be enjoy myself, hedonism, and enjoy the world. So on one hand, you're denying Esau's offspring. You're denying them their pleasure of this world, which was the gift from Isaac. That was their blessing. Hine, here it is for you. The world's your oyster. You're saying you can't have that anymore. You need restraint. We need self-restraint in this world and conviction. You can become Israel. But at the end, they're not going to get spiritually satisfied because that's not really who they are. So unfortunately, they're caught in a no-win situation. They're denied the here and now. And the afterlife is not really for them. It's not going to be given like pleasure to them, if you will. It's just not who they are. So how does it manifest itself? They strike out against the Jews. And I think if you look at, especially in European history, I mean, obviously we're talking in generality, sweeping generality here. Obviously, it goes without saying. But there's no question that if you look historically, since the fall of the Roman Empire, the more strict they were in their adherence of, let's say, church ran the state, no separation, what do you have as a result? You have anti-Semitism in these countries more than ever in history. And what country, ironically, has become the greatest bastion of freedom for the Jewish people? Right here, United States of America. Why do you think that is? Because what were we founded on? Separation of church and state. The Roman Catholics are not going to run this show. In other words, we have Catholics in America, but they're not Catholics like you over there. They'll watch football on Sunday afternoon, right? They'll go to church, but it's like a light version of Catholicism. And no one kills each other because this guy's a Protestant, this guy's like, it's not like in Ireland where, you know, bombs are being the IRA versus it, right? No, it's a very light form, benign form of, look at America's religion by and large, right? Americans are very relaxed about religion. It's like, it's another lifestyle, it's another religion, it's okay with me, you do that, it's okay. It's vanilla, it's chocolate, it's strawberry, everything's kosher, right? It's okay. But that's, you know, it's a coincidence that we've had hundreds of years of peace with ostensibly people who are descended from the nations of Edom, of Esau. You know why that is? Because look at America. Is it okay to sort of just do what you want to do in America? Absolutely. Are there limitations how much money you can make? No. You can be as successful as you dream. Just dream and it's yours. I'm not going to take anything. There's no punitive measures to confiscate and take away for the lands of the church or this. You just make your money and enjoy. And guess what? When the family of Esau are enjoying this world, they don't look with jealousy and enmity towards the Jacob. Why should they? They're enjoying their world. They're enjoying it. Right? It's only when the religious thing comes into it that it becomes a little scary. You want to hear something staggering? I'll leave you with this. And this is true. My Rosh Hashanah, my Rebbe has pointed this up. This is amazing. Okay. You remember Jacob says to Esau, you pass ahead. The world's yours. I'll come at my own pace. But what has Jacob given to the non-Jewish nations of the world? You know what we've done for them? A lot. We've kept them very happy. You remember how, what did Jacob keep giving Esau? Kept giving him money and gifts. Let me ask you something. Who set up the monetary system, the Western world monetary system? Jews did this, okay? Specifically, what family created the Western system that we use now in America? You know, the family was a famous Jewish family. You've heard of them. They're called the Rothschilds. Look it up. Go on. Google the Rothschilds. Translate the name. Rothschild. Shield of red. The protector of brother red. Their family's name and their shield. Their actual shield is shield with... So they are... I mean, it's obviously a coincidence on some level, but the name of the family, the Jewish family, who allowed dear brother Esau to live and to enjoy his money, to invest his money, to have the money, their family's name and the sigil is Red Shield, the shield of red. Who is Mr. Red? Edom, Esau. And the shield means the protector, the magen, the one who's looking after his brother. So by setting up this monetary system for the world, the Rothschilds are keeping a benign, very apathetic in terms of religion, Esau. Amazing, right? It's amazing. That I have no answer for. It's eerie when Marcia pointed that out, the idea of the Rothschild, because that's what their name means. So let us hope and let us pray that the blessing of Jacob has the nuclear option, always with Torah, with the things that we can bring to the table uniquely that are Jewish. And thank God, you know, Jacob really did know what he was doing. So, yes, it looks ostensibly like he snatched defeat from victory, but in reality, Jacob is a very wise man, and he had a plan, and the plan was to protect us from the wrath of Esau, and it almost worked in the end. And it worked for many, many years, and many, many Jewish lives were saved. And we say Shabbat Shalom, and a thank you to dear grandfather Jacob.